Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. I'm excited about our guest today.
Me too. We have Charles Booker, Representative Charles Booker, on the show today. Jasmine predicted him as the MVP, or Rookie of the Year. Well, he might have gotten both. I don't know.
Yeah.
He did an incredible job this session. We were really happy to be able to talk to him just about this year's session, how he approached it, a lot of the different ways he went about advancing different legislation that he went on to see passed, and just also his thoughts about how to change things and how things can get better using state government. So it was a good discussion. I'm really excited for you guys to hear it. But before we speak to him, we have lots of other stuff to get to. The session is officially over. Jasmine's going to talk to us about a couple of things that passed at the very end, including some changes to some pension stuff and also the State Board of Education, some changes there. The Medicaid waiver was overturned by the federal government again, so I'm going to talk to us a little bit about that. We're going to finish up with some quick hits. So without any further ado, Jasmine, tell us about quasis.
Okay, so HB 358 is the bill that we're talking about, and this is a pension bill that passed in the late hours of the last day of the session. So this bill we actually talked about a few weeks ago with Bruce Maples, and it would allow post-secondary institutions and quasi-government agencies, which are like county health departments and things like that, to opt out of participation in the Kentucky Employees Retirement System by paying the actuarial costs.
Right.
So they define post-secondary institution, and it includes basically like the regional schools like EKU, WKU, Kentucky State.
Right.
And then a number of quasi-governmental agencies. So these agencies can stay in the Kentucky retirement system and begin paying 84% of their payroll as their share of pension contributions, which is what the rest of the state government paid this year.
Which is a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Or they can leave the KRS by July of 2020 and pay off their pension liabilities by one of two ways, either by lump sum or starting at their current rate of 49% of payroll and then gradually increasing by 1.5% a year until they're finished paying them off.
Which is just kind of wild to think about, that they're currently paying 49%, and the way that they've changed the obligation math, they now have to pay 84%. So that's a huge jump.
Right, that's huge. And so here's another wrinkle to that. If they fall behind, the state is going to take over management until the payments are made, which can mean that even long-term employees of the agency could be switched into defined contribution plans rather than defined benefit pension.
Right, which, yeah, that seems weird.
So that might be, this is another thing where there might be an issue with the inviolable contract because they were promised a certain benefit, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if these agencies quit the KRS, new hires would be put into defined contribution plans, which we've talked about several times, are more like 401ks.
Right.
So the House version of this bill that got passed is better than the Senate version that we started with, where current employees would all be put into defined contribution plans.
Mm-hmm. But then again, the Senate version would have probably opened some inviolable contract issues and ended up in court.
Right, exactly. This was definitely a compromise bill.
Right.
But it's estimated that this is going to cost KRS an estimated $799 million.
Right, right.
The point of this bill is trying to prevent situations like what happened with Centerstone in 2013. Centerstone filed bankruptcy.
So Centerstone used to be called Seven Counties. Mm-hmm. It's like they do like mental health and I don't know. How do you describe what Centerstone is?
Mental health treatment, but they also have lots of different community programs and resources and addiction treatment and all kinds of things.
Yeah. They hire a lot of social workers.
Yeah.
In Louisville. And so in 2013, they couldn't pay, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what happened.
And so they ended up filing bankruptcy.
Right.
And, you know, these quasi-government agencies would have the option to do that.
Right.
But opponents say that this might not solve that problem at all because quasis might not be able to afford either option because they're both really
expensive.
Difficult, right? Like one's a lump sum or one's increasing your percentage every year to 84%, which is
a lot.
When
you're not even getting any benefits out of it at that point.
Yeah. And so these agencies might not be able to afford either option, and they might still have to file bankruptcy or drastically cut their services.
Right.
Derek Graham called it a steady dismantling of the defined benefit plan.
Sure.
And because we're just trying to put as many people into these defined contribution plans as possible at this point. The compromise final version of the bill passed the Senate 26-11 and then went to the House and passed 58-39 less than an hour before they had to adjourn at midnight.
Yeah, that last number that you mentioned, 58-39, that does make me wonder, and I've been wondering about this since it passed, and I actually don't know the answer. So this does create a liability for KRS of, you know, like you mentioned, almost $800 million.
Right, because people are buying out of it and not paying.
Yeah. And right. So that makes sense. You're creating a liability by basically reducing the total amount you're going to get paid. Anything that creates a liability, I believe, needs to be passed with 60 votes in the House. So it only passed 58-39, 60 votes on an odd numbered session.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that could end up in court. So it might happen. I don't know. But yeah, this is one of those things where it's really tough because there aren't any good answers. The pension's underfunded. We need more funding. We probably don't need the amount of increase that we actually saw in order to accommodate the underfunding that we've seen. But we don't want all these quasis to go out of business. We don't want there to be no health department in a lot of counties. So we want to find a way to accommodate those people. I'm not totally sold that the way that they went about doing it was the best way to do it because, like Derek Graham said, it just basically moves a lot of people from the defined benefit to the defined contribution plan, which is a reduction in benefits, essentially, for all these employees, while those groups still have to pay the defined benefit cost. Or at least ramping up to that defined benefit cost. So there you go. So that's that bill. This was probably the biggest action. Like you said, it passed right before the end of the session. But there was other stuff that happened. Jasmine, tell us about the Board of Education.
Okay, so last Thursday, the Senate confirmed 9 new Board of Education appointments. They concurred on 8 of those 9, but one person was singled out that they debated over, Gary Houchins. Houchins is a professor at WKU who's been very outspoken in his support of school choice, including charter schools and scholarship tax credits and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Morgan McGarvey commented that Houchins is someone who has warred with our educators.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Strong words from the minority leader.
Another note, some of the appointments are not new, including Gary Houchins. They're actually reappointments that were first appointed in 2016, including Houchins and Alisa Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
So the other 7 have actually been serving since 2018, even though they were just confirmed. So they were appointed right after the 2018 session. So they really got the benefit of serving for a full year without even being confirmed.
A smart move by the governor.
Because the way this works by statute is that the governor can make appointments, but then they have to be approved in the next session if the appointments are made when the legislature is not in session.
Right. So you will always see people get appointed to these boards literally the day after session ends, no matter who's the governor.
Yeah.
That's just the smart way to do it.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
So these board members were serving at the time that Stephen Pruitt, you know, forcibly resigned and Wayne Lewis replaced him. Houchins said that he voted against the measure that forced Pruitt to resign and that he's always maintained his independence on the board. So Houchins was still confirmed 19-17, but some Republicans did cross party lines. So Alice Forgy Kerr, Tom Buford, C.B. Embry, Stephen Meredith, Dan Syme, Brandon Smith, and Philip Wheeler all voted against. Right. That's why I named them all, because these aren't always the Republicans that we see crossing party lines sometimes, except maybe Alice Forgy Kerr.
Sure.
So kind of a more diverse group.
Yeah, we don't know much about Philip Wheeler yet since he's the new guy from Pikeville. But yeah, Dan Syme is one of the most conservative folks in
there.
And we aren't seeing names like Julie Rackey Adams, who, you know, while being one of the more moderate senators, is very, very conservative on some of these education things.
Right. So just a little bit about the Board of Education in general. So Board of Education members serve 4-year terms, but then they can serve a second term and be reappointed. But the strange thing about these appointments is that Gary Houchins and Alisa Johnson were moved from at-large members to district members. So there are 7 members of the board that come from each Supreme Court district in the state, and then there's 4 at-large members. So instead of a 4-year term that would have expired in 2020, it seems that by maybe moving them to different positions, Hauchins and Johnson are getting 6-year terms instead of 2 4-year terms and may have the potential to be reappointed again. I'm not sure. And I'm not sure of the legality of that.
And I don't, it seems like probably nobody is. And unless there's like litigation to actually figure all this out, it probably will just end up being like
and
that.
Forward Kentucky had a really good piece about this that Bruce Maples wrote. And, you know, he gets all the credit for this because he pointed this out.
Yeah.
But basically, this switch around, you know, you're like, well, why would they do that if they can just serve 2 4-year terms? Well, it does ensure that they stay on the board until at least 2022. So that means that even if Bevin is out of office in 2020, they still have 2 years left on the board.
Right. Right. Well, there you go. Yeah. Unless they, you know, somebody comes in after him and just totally reorganizes the board like he
did.
So
that happened before.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, that's not everything that happened at the end of the session, but those are two of the bigger things. We'll go over some of the last other stuff that happened at the end of the session at the end of the show. But there was another really big piece of news that happened last week, and that's that the Medicaid waiver was overturned in federal court again.
Judge Boasberg, man.
Judge Boasberg. So Judge Boasberg, who actually overturned Kentucky Health once already, has done it again. Just to catch up a little bit. So Governor Beshear, he expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. This is probably the biggest piece of his administration. I think he's gone out and said it's the thing he's the most proud of. The law allowed states to expand their Medicaid programs, with federal government paying 100% of the costs, which then dropped to 90% after 3 years. So, you know, while you hear a lot of hand-wringing about how expensive this group is, the federal government is paying 90% of the costs for these people, even today. So while Governor Beshear opted for the full expansion, just basically saying everybody who qualifies under the ACA gets this expansion, a few moderate states opted for what's called an 1115 waiver, which is allowed under the Social Security Act, which is where Medicaid is technically housed. And these 1115 waivers, which are supposed to be for experiments inside of Social Security programs, they expanded Medicaid and kind of limited the expansion, which may or may not kind of go against the way that 1115s were envisioned to work. But Arkansas was a state that kind of pioneered this strategy. They kind of went to the Obama administration and said, yeah, we know you want us to expand our Medicaid population. We're game to do that, but we want to do it in a more moderate way than the ACA itself actually goes about doing that. And the Obama administration said, oh, okay, we think that that's okay. We would rather you actually do some expansion than, you know, fight about what an 1115 waiver is. So anyways, once Governor Bevin was elected, he sought to move Kentucky from, you know, this full expansion that Governor Beshear put into place to one that included things that were in some of these 1115 waivers, including work requirements or like community engagement is what the term that they use in the waiver itself. They also included premiums, so people would have to pay premiums for their Medicaid. They would have to have reporting requirements. There would be lockouts if they didn't meet the reporting requirements, and lots of other items that are essentially ways to have less people enrolled in Medicaid. And Governor Bevin argued that these programs would teach Medicaid recipients responsibility. I guess Governor Bevin just thinks the state of Kentucky should be all these people's parents, I guess. So the proposal was overturned once by Judge Boasberg. And we talked about this on the show when it happened. And Boasberg said that the federal government did not consider the wealth of comments opposing the program.
Right. We learned from that opinion just how important public commenting is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I knew that from law school, but now everybody knows, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. So we do have people who whipped people to get like all these comments in, which was very key. You know, places like Mississippi didn't see that many comments about their Medicaid waiver, and it went through without much of an issue. But yeah, these public comments really made a difference. So yeah, that was what caused it to be overturned the first time, but now it's been overturned again. So Boasberg's opinion actually runs to 58 pages, and it grants the plaintiffs summary judgment, completely blocking the implementation of the program. That's what summary judgment means, right?
Right. It's like a judgment on the merits without a trial.
Right. So the central argument of the plaintiffs was that the Medicaid program is different from many other social programs, such as temporary assistance for needy families, which is also known as TANF, or what some people would call welfare, and also different than the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which a lot of people also call food stamps. And the statutes that created SNAP and TANF Work requirements and the like are like explicitly allowed in the statute. But Medicaid, which is housed under the Social Security Act, Medicaid's sole purpose is the provision of medical assistance to poor people. And that's what Boasberg kind of based his entire opinion around by agreeing with the plaintiffs on that point. So this is from the opinion, quote, at bottom, the record shows that 95,000 people would lose Medicaid coverage, and yet the secretary paid no attention to that deprivation, nor did he address how Kentucky Health would otherwise help furnish medical assistance. In other words, he glossed over the impact of the state's project on the individuals whom Medicaid was enacted to protect. By doing so, he failed to consider adequately a salient purpose of Medicaid and thus an important aspect of the program. The court consequentially cannot validate his approval of Kentucky Health.
Boom.
Boom. Drop the mic. Except for that, he didn't drop the mic. He went on for several more
pages. there's more, actually.
Yes. Boasberg also lays out the three specific arguments of the Bevin administration in their waiver application and why they failed to meet the statutory requirements of Medicaid. So the first one that Boasberg looks at is the health and well-being. With the waiver kind of makes the claim that community engagement improves the overall health of recipients. That claim is pretty dubious, and there were a lot of what's the plural of amicus? Amici? Amici? Amici?
Amici?
Amici.
Amici?
Multiple
amicus. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I know how to spell it.
Yeah, so there were lots of briefs that were filed, amicus briefs, which are like friend of the court briefs, that kind of said that the idea of community engagement improving health was very dubious. But the opinion actually says it doesn't really matter. We're not going to make a judgment about the veracity of the argument about the community engagement improving health. But this is from the opinion. The secretary's analysis instead fails for a more basic reason. It is little more than sleight of hand. At each step, the secretary impermissibly conflated improving health and wellness with the Medicaid Act's more specific stated purpose of furnishing medical assistance and rehabilitative and other services. Put another way, this focus on health is no substitute for considering Medicaid's central concern, covering health costs.
Right. So he's saying that you took this one factor, which is improving health and wellness, and elevated it over this more basic one of covering health costs.
Yeah, right? Basically saying the same thing he did again. boom.
Yeah, like we already told you this.
Yeah. So the next thing, the second thing that the Bevin administration put forth was cost considerations. And the waiver makes the case that Kentucky's limited Medicaid dollars needed to be spent on what they called the traditional population who had Medicaid coverage before the ACA. And this is from the opinion. To the extent that Secretary Azar concluded that the Act's objectives do not include furnishing medical assistance to the expansion group, his interpretation would be utterly unreasonable in light of Medicaid's text, structure, and legislative history. He must thus evaluate the effect of Kentucky Health on all Medicaid recipients, including low-income individuals, and he must do so without prioritizing certain groups over others. Here, that means the secretary has an obligation to at least consider the 95,000 people who would lose Medicaid coverage, even if those people were largely members of the expansion group. So basically, there's law. It's called the Affordable Care Act. It says you have to consider all these people equally.
Yeah, makes sense.
Okay, and the last point that Bevin administration makes in their waiver is called self-sufficiency. The waiver claims that reducing reliance on public assistance is an important thing to consider when trying to cover the expansion population. And then this again is directly from the opinion. The court has doubts whether such an objective is proper. So that is really kind of a boom. There you go.
Yeah. He's like, again, the purpose of the Medicaid Act is furnishing medical assistance.
All right. So anyways, that's Boasberg's opinion. Granted summary judgment, the Medicaid waiver is totally blocked. And Governor Bevin was big mad about the ruling. That's a very online term. His comments after the ruling came forth were this. The problem is with a single judge in Washington, D.C., who I wonder if this judge has ever been to Kentucky or Arkansas or any of these other states that he would presume to know what is best for. I think it is reasonable, frankly, that he is messing up the lives of millions of people based on his own personal predilections, and it is hard for me to understand the logic. So that's one quote. Another quote is, quote, he doesn't seem to care whether or not people are healthy or whether they are leading healthier lives or whether states have ideas to help people get on their feet. He seems to be driven more by ideology. So this will be contested and we will appeal this up the line.
It's weird the governor doesn't like so many judges.
Yeah. It's almost as though he thinks little of anyone's opinion who differs from his. Governor Bevin there says, you know, they're going to reappeal this up to the Supreme Court. That's probably going to happen. But Governor Bevin also has claimed throughout this process that if the waiver were overturned, he would just outright cancel the whole expansion. That's definitely worrying, but we are now in the midst of a gubernatorial campaign and Matt Bevin is running again. I do think that this reduces the likelihood that Bevin makes such a move, at least during the campaign. I don't see him like saying, okay, we're canceling the medical benefits of 95,000 people in the middle of a gubernatorial campaign right before people go to vote.
But that's a reason not to reelect him.
Yeah, absolutely.
That he might do it later.
Absolutely. That is true. But yeah, I do think that one of the big strategies was to get to the election so that he couldn't, you know, make this move unless he wanted to make a lot of people angry. And that's been successful. But we will see what the governor does. He, you know, for all the things we say about him that we don't like, he does kind of follow through even if things are unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
So we will certainly see what happens there. So that was a lot about the Medicaid waiver being overturned. But yeah, big news there.
And huge props to the Kentucky Equal Justice Center once again.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there's a bunch of groups involved in this, but you know, the work of both Kara Stewart, who's no longer with them, and Ben Carter, who you know owns the
building. Let's just use this building.
Yeah, their work has been phenomenal throughout this entire process. Okay, Jasmine, you mentioned two things that happened at the end of the session, but we need to talk about at least a few more. You know, you mentioned that Bruce Maples had a really nice write-up about the Board of Education stuff that went on there at the last day of the session, but he actually had a really nice write-up of everything that
really
happened.
Really everything, yeah.
Yeah, and you should definitely go check that out. So, you know, here's a few of the other things that did happen. So, one, the Tobacco-Free Schools Act passed, so now there will be no smoking in schools and no vaping. No vaping allowed. So, get your...
No jewels in the bathroom.
No jewels in the bathroom. Get your... candy apple cherry flavored fake cigarettes out of here. That's one thing. The pregnancy accommodations bill also passed. That's big news.
Yeah, good news. Yeah. When, you know, a session with not a lot of good news. That was something, a bright light at the end, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I do think, you know, the past 2 years in the legislature, there haven't been any women in leadership. I do believe that every caucus, except for the Democrats in the Senate, have a female who is in their leadership. And I don't think it's a coincidence that you're seeing that bill pass after you see more female representation in leadership.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. We also had the tax cleanup bill passed. We didn't really talk about this one, even though it was a really big deal. And the reason we didn't talk about it is because it was in a free conference committee until literally the last hour of the session. It turned out the bill will cost $3.5 million a year, and basically nobody knew what was in it when it passed. So, like, it was in a free conference committee. Free conference committee means that anything can be considered, even stuff that wasn't in either bill to start with. So you don't have any starting point. It can include anything. They didn't even get their report back until the last day. They didn't vote on it till like, the hour before the session was over. There's no way anybody could have known what was in this bill when they voted for it, and it still passed. Very, very suboptimal. Even though these tax cleanups were very important, they needed to happen, it was very irresponsible the way they were done. And once we get more information about what's actually in there, we will probably talk about it more. Bruce also talks in his article about other stuff that didn't happen that might have. And the two things I focused in on here I wanted to talk to you about was that the bill, there was a bill that would have made sexual harassment against the rules of the legislature. You know, that's been a huge issue in the past couple of years, and it failed to pass. So, you know, still not technically against the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is suboptimal as well. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, the CIO pay bill, which was sponsored by Republicans, which would have cut the pay of Charles Grindle. It didn't pass either. Anyways, definitely, definitely, definitely go check out Bruce's write-up on forwardky.com. We'll have links to it in the newsletter. Definitely go check those out if you want to know more about the stuff that happened on the last day of session.
And we're not just saying that because... we're in partnership with them. It's actually really good information.
Yeah, well, we're in partnership.
And they cover a lot more than we do.
Yeah, we're in partnership with them because they do such a good job.
Yeah, so exactly.
There you go. Okay, before we get out of here and listen to our interview with Charles Booker, here are some quick hits. Jasmine, Andy Beshear is on the air. His first television ad of the campaign focuses on the Affordable Care Act. It's not as memorable as the Adam Edelin song. He doesn't spell B-E-S-H-E-A-R or anything. But I do think the ad is good. It focuses on an important issue that resonates with Democrats in a big way. And
it definitely seems like he's using like what his dad did that, you know, that was his big thing, and yes. he's kind of continuing.
Well, I mean, his dad did it, but it was a big deal, and it's right. something that we definitely need to protect. So I would hope that Adam Edelin's not going to be like, or Rocky Atkins is not going to be like, well, just because I don't like the Bashirs, no Medicare expansion. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's a good issue to run on. So good for him for pointing that out. Okay, Jasmine, Jeff Walls, who at least for the moment is the University of Louisville's women's basketball coach, he called out Governor Bevin on Twitter when the governor recognized the University of Kentucky's men's basketball team for making the Elite Eight, but ignored the Louisville women for achieving the exact same feat.
Yeah, and I noticed after they were out of the tournament, Adam Edelin made a point to talk about the U of L women and how proud he was of them. So he learned from Governor Bevin's mistake.
Yeah, I mean, the Louisville women absolutely got jobbed. There's no reason they should have been playing Connecticut. Connecticut deserved the one
seed. In Hartford?
Yeah, not fair. Not fair.
It was really unfair.
But, you know, they almost pulled it out. Unfortunately, they didn't. Kentucky's men also lost. So no Final Four for anybody in Kentucky this year. Not even Bellarmine fans. I think they also lost in the Elite Eight. So there you go. this is a story we've talked about on Quick Hits before, but U of L Hospital is seeking a partner to buy Jewish Hospital. The saga of Jewish Hospital is long and drawn out. U of L hasn't found a partner to buy Jewish Hospital yet, but they have been given an extension to find a partner. They said that they got some responses to their request for proposal, but the respondents didn't really feel like they had enough time to fully vet the situation. So that's hopeful. That means that there are some people that are legitimately interested in helping U of L keep this important piece of health infrastructure going in the city of Louisville. But it's not ideal. It's not great that people are like, oh, we're not sure if this is going to work out. We'd rather than have them say like, yeah, we're gung-ho about it. And lastly, Drew Curtis has dropped out of the race for auditor. Jasmine, you showed me this on Facebook. It was big news.
Mm-hmm.
His move drops the field to three candidates, which is still kind of a lot. So we have Sherry Donahue, who ran for state senate in East Louisville, Kelsey Hayes Coots, a teacher in Louisville, and Chris Toby, who we actually had on the show. You can listen to our interview with him if you'd like. Mr. Curtis cited other commitments as his reasons for leaving the race, which that didn't sit well. Like, that didn't sit great with me. Like, yeah, if you're going to be auditor, that's going to be your job. We don't need, like, a auditor who's, like, doing other things as well, I would think.
Well, then maybe it's good that he dropped out.
Yeah, I think so. Anyways, there it is. All right, let's get to our interview with Representative Charles Booker.
All right. Charles Booker is the Kentucky representative from District 43, which runs from west to east Louisville along the river. Since joining us back in June, he won his election and is serving in his first legislative session in Frankfort. He's been really busy. He sponsored 15 bills this session, more than double any other freshman Democrat, and he's listed as a sponsor on 50 bills. So we're really excited to talk to him again about his transition into Frankfort and what he hopes to accomplish in the future. So Charles Booker, welcome back to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you all.
All right. So after winning in a very crowded primary, you won your general election with relative ease, winning with 77% of the vote and winning more votes than all but nine other Democrats that had contested elections. So even though you had what some people would say might be an easy general election, you never stopped campaigning. So tell us why you did that and whether or not you think it's helped you as a representative.
Well, thank you for that question. I think it's really important to sort of set the tone for what type of leader you're going to be. And everyone's voice in the 43rd and across the Commonwealth is important. There are no days off because life doesn't stop when the voting ends. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I wanted to make sure people knew that I was going to be reaching out to them throughout. So I wanted to engage over the summer. And you take nothing for granted, too. This is a very surreal time. We didn't expect the person who is currently in the White House to
right,
be there.
Right, yep. You never know.
So you take nothing for granted. So, and I've actually kept that going. So even during the session, we sent out surveys, setting up canvassing just to talk mm-hmm. to folks and see how they're doing to get ideas from them. So campaigning shouldn't just be around election time.
Yeah.
And engaging certainly shouldn't mm-hmm. just be around election time.
Yeah. Representative Josie Raymond actually said the first time she was on our show that state representatives have a responsibility to organize their district. And she does a good job of that. But I think you actually do an incredible job of that. Like you just mentioned, you know, really kind of organizing your district, organizing the people in your district in a political sense so they understand what you're doing and what's at stake in the state government. You've done a really good job with that.
Well, and you know, to be clear, when I say campaigning, I'm talking about how we mobilize for change.
Right.
Not to vote for me again. Mm-hmm. The whole reason I wanted to go to Frankfurt was to empower the voices in the community so we can push for real mm-hmm. changes across the board. And that means that we got to be engaged at all times. So mm-hmm. I'm excited to tear up all my shoes and be as accessible as I possibly can. And I think that folks appreciate it.
Absolutely. So you've actually been among the most active representatives in the session that recently ended. We mentioned at the top, you're the chief sponsor of 15 different bills. However, you know, none of those bills really even received a hearing in committee.
A couple did.
They did. Okay. A few did. Is that what you expected to happen? And this is just kind of like putting forth these bills. Does that help to build momentum for change?
Well, you know, for me as a staff for LRC, and then understanding that I was not just going into a space to engage in legislation, but to set a message for the Commonwealth. I wanted to sort of introduce myself and let folks know why I'm in the space. And I knew that certain pieces of legislation would help to tell my story. So mm-hmm. Even if you listen to me on the floor, a lot of times when I'd give remarks, I would tell my story.
Sure.
Because for me, my story is the story of a lot of Kentuckians that doesn't get heard. Mm-hmm. So I knew that in the minority, in a minority in the minority, uh-huh. it would be difficult to move a lot of pieces of legislation, but we had some success. Even if that was putting a bill in a Republican's bill. So mm-hmm. The emergency prescription refill legislation, House Bill 64,
right.
that was a bill that I worked on with a Republican member from Green, calling my brother, Representative Danny Bentley. Uh-huh. He carried the bill.
Right.
Because I understand the dynamics at play.
Uh-huh, right.
But I was campaigning hard for that legislation. Mm-hmm. And so we got that passed and expungement yeah. as well.
Danny Bentley is actually my mother and father-in-law's representative. So there you go. Very interesting. So your bills, they actually, the 15 that you sponsored, they touch on a lot of different subjects.
Yeah.
Many are about parole and criminal justice issues. But you know, you even sponsored a constitutional amendment to lower the age for service in the Kentucky legislature to 18 years old. You sponsored a bill to help ease the youth homelessness crisis. You know, it's a huge issue here in Louisville. And a bill to allow early voting and a bill to increase minority representations at schools with majority minority populations.
Yeah.
What's the overarching theme to this stuff that you're co-sponsoring or that you're sponsoring ahead of everybody else?
The theme for me in Frankfurt and pretty much any space I'm going to be in is empowering voices of those that are marginalized and are unheard and leveling the playing field for everyone. So whenever there's an opportunity to make things fair, to find equity, those are where I'm going to insert myself. So you'll see that common theme amongst all the pieces of legislation. And I want to add that restoration of voting rights, mm-hmm. House Bill 91, that was the first piece I filed jointly with Representative Brown mm-hmm. that we did get a hearing on. And very excited to push that. We're pushing it already in the summer, already plan to pre-file it.
Awesome. So for a very long time, and you talked a little bit about this already, but for a long time, the lived experiences of younger black men have only been heard secondhand in the legislature. And, you know, we've had some champions that have brought stories of people who look like you to the floor, but never have people really heard from people who look like you directly. So how have you used your presence, your physical presence as a member of the legislature to ensure that all perspectives are recognized in the lawmaking process?
You know what? I really appreciate that question because I'm humbled every time I step into the state capitol because I know I'm there for a lot of people. And I know that the vantage point I speak from is very unique in the room. And a lot of times I look around and I know that if I don't talk, there's a vantage point that's going to get left out. And so really what I wanted to do is tell my story to do that very thing. To humanize mm-hmm. Perspectives that are typically just looked at as numbers or side notes in a bill, such mm-hmm. as the gang bill. I wanted
right.
to put a face to some of these issues. And oftentimes I'd pull out a dog tag of my cousin TJ, talked about my relatives who were murdered. I would explain how bills would affect specific people. I actually acted out a scene of a shooting of what would happen with Senate Bill 150. So I know it's important. I know it makes a difference, and I'm honored to do it.
Yeah. Just as a follow-up to that really quickly, you know, there was a piece today in the newspaper just kind of about, you know, you using your presence and how it might have made a couple of people feel kind of uncomfortable. Talk a little bit about, you know, how you deal with that, the fact that, you know, people don't have to confront people who look like you often, especially if they're from places where, you know, there isn't as much minority representation or even presence in those communities. Talk a little bit about how you deal with some of the conflict that's arisen from that.
Yeah, well, you know, I welcome it, and I always call myself a troublemaker. good trouble in the spirit of Congressman John Lewis.
Sure.
I think some discomfort is helpful when we're trying to shake the status quo. I often talk about system level change, but I come at it with a very humble and mindful perspective. I know that there are different vantage points, and even when it comes to an issue such as racism, and I talk about it at a systemic level, but there are folks that have been on the complete side of, different side of the street from me, and they have a lived experience that's different from mine. And in order for me to communicate with them, I have to find a way to understand and tap into the space that they're in. And I'm very aware of that. And so when I try to talk, I don't want to demonize. I don't want to put people in a defensive crouch, but I'm going to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to sponsoring lots of legislation of your own, you've worked closely with other members of the legislature, too. You mentioned the bill with George Brown Jr. And of the seven total bills that he sponsored, you were a co-sponsor on five of them, and you also co-sponsored six of Representative Attica Scott's bills. Tell us a little bit about how you've gone about building relationships through co-sponsorship and then how you've recruited co-sponsors for your own bills.
Yeah, well, building relationships up there is everything. So I took it upon myself to reach out to members on both sides of the aisle. Actually, one of the biggest victories I would take from this session beyond getting a hearing for House Bill 91 mm-hmm. was actually on pretrial reform. Republican member, I was filing a piece of legislation around ending cash bail. That concept is very noble. I want that to happen.
Yeah.
But there were some concerns in his bill.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down with him, explained my concerns. I filed my legislation, and we were able to pump the brakes on it and, mm-hmm. and stop a bill that could have caused some harm to some marginalized communities. And that's how you do it. You got to figure out ways to sit down and find commonalities and listen. And it's been a great ride. I'm grateful for the relationships I built. Like I said, meeting with Republican members from East and West Kentucky. And so now we're going to travel. I'm going to bring some of them to West Louisville.
Nice.
Good.
And I think that's what it's going to take.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned both the cash bail reform and restoration of voting rights. Those are the two specific issues we had to talk to you about that we wanted to ask about. So, you know, there was major talk about bail reform, and you told a little bit of the story just right before us. But it did kind of look like before the session started, there was a real possibility this session for something to pass. But once the session started, you know, everything kind of fizzled, and clearly there was some stuff happening behind the scenes. So tell us kind of what you think about the current proposals out there, kind of what the problems you had with HB 94 were, and what needs to be done to move bail reform forward, and kind of what you think its prospects are for the next few sessions.
Yeah, well, as far as the prospects, I'm hopeful. I think that the conversations were really healthy this session. I'm glad we were able to pump the brakes and not cause some unintended harm. My biggest concern with House Bill 94 was the fact that it didn't address people being held pre-trial
mm-hmm.
the way it needed to. What we don't want to have happen is we end cash bail, but now we find other reasons
yeah.
to hold folks
pre-trial.
Then we
hold people indefinitely without
exactly.
a means to get out.
Exactly. And this is where the conversation of systemic racism is really important.
Yeah.
Because the sponsor was speaking from a standpoint of, well, let's give judicial discretion. And in a perfect world, yes, that would be
mm-hmm.
good. But if we are dealing with a system that's built on biases that are woven in to where certain populations are not going to get the same level of fair discretion,
you still get a similar result.
We got to be mindful of that. Yeah. And it's not a thing of I don't trust judges or I don't trust legislators to act in good faith. It's there are blind spots out there.
Sure.
So back to your other bill, we've also heard some talk about restoration of voting rights for former felons for, you know, more than a decade now. But there was some renewed hope for that reform
yes,
in Kentucky
yes.
this year. Restoration of voting rights has passed the House several times, but it's always failed in the Senate. You know, the reform failed to get through the legislature this year once again. But what are your prospects for future sessions?
Well, I'm very excited about our prospects for 2020. As I mentioned, I've already made the request to pre-file, but we should have that done before the month is out.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get the campaign going. And some good things to note, all of the gubernatorial candidates have expressed support for it, certainly on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Bevin has said he supports it as well. The chair of judiciary is in support.
The chair of judiciary in the Senate or the House?
In the House.
Okay, right.
In the House. So we got work to do in the Senate.
Sure.
But I think there's a coalition that's growing, and there's an energy that we haven't seen in a long time. And I know I have a part to play in that. So I'm really excited about the work we're going to do over the summer, mm-hmm. getting ready for 2020.
Okay, good. We're definitely going to be tracking that as things move forward.
Yes, please do.
Okay, so, you know, you talked a little bit about this as well, but one of the ways that you've made your voice heard is actually on the floor of the House. You know, you read out a list of the names who were lynched in Kentucky on the House floor, which is not something that's ever been done before. That was very powerful. You acted out a shooting on the House floor, which, you know, is something I don't think has happened either. It's something that was very unique and I think opened a lot of people's eyes to the realities of what gun violence looks like.
Yeah.
You spoke about the contributions of artist and chemist Elmer Lucille Allen, which is, you know, a moment of like black excellence, which, again, not often happens on the floor of the House, to the whole state. So tell us about the impact that your work on the actual floor has done so far this session.
Yeah. And I quoted Tupac.
Yeah. Might have happened before. I'm not sure.
Yeah. You know, I see this space as a tremendous platform. Mm-hmm. And I know that as an elected official now, whenever I speak, not only am I speaking on behalf of the Commonwealth, but I'm speaking to the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm in those spaces, that's my audience. Mm-hmm. And anyone I talk to, I want to be talking to the entire Commonwealth, even as I'm talking to you. And honestly, I take some lessons from my mom. Both of my parents are ministers. And there is a certain level of knowing how to communicate to your audience and pull them in and take them on a journey so they can see where you're trying to go. Mm-hmm. And I think the floor of the House is a perfect venue for that, mm-hmm. Not only for the other members that may have never seen this type of thing before, but for the entire Commonwealth. And everywhere I go, I get folks that tell me how much they appreciated my remarks mm-hmm. on the floor, which is a concept I hadn't heard much of before. Yeah. So,
well, I do think that there's been a lot more this session, especially there's been a lot more kind of sharing of these videos on social mm-hmm. media.
Yeah.
I hadn't really seen that before either. You know, I'm kind of a nerd, so I see them on KET or whatever, but that they're kind of more showing up on Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, where people are yeah. able to see them. So I do think that you're getting more of an audience that way.
Oh yeah, it makes a difference. Well, you know, that's part of having some youth in the room. We know how to use social media.
Yeah, yeah. And just lastly on that point, we talked a little bit about, you know, kind of how there's been some discomfort with some of the back and forth that's happened. And I do know that, you know, some leaders have talked about the need for more civility. How does that call resonate with you? Does that make you uncomfortable, or do you feel like that is something that we need more of?
Well, I think we need our leadership to lead and to make sure that extreme, very divisive, harmful pieces of legislation or even resolutions are kept from the floor. I'm very civil. But
you really are. It's not. It's absolutely true. It's.
But at the same time, this is more about getting to the heart of problems that we're facing and addressing divides. So this is not a both sides conversation. This is really, and particularly for folks that are in the leadership on the Republican Party, to have a look at what does it mean for us to come together. Mm-hmm. They hold all the cards. They have the supermajority. So there were certain times resolutions or bills where discussion was had that was simply to demean. I mentioned how I've had relatives in my family who were lynched, but yet, and I mentioned it on the floor and explained to legislators that it is tremendously offensive to your peer to continue to compare abortion to lynching. Mm-hmm. I explained how racism is a system. Mm-hmm. And then, but it continued. Mm-hmm. And that's where leadership could come in and stop that. So I hope that the lessons from this past session, with so many folks being vocal, which is a good thing, mm-hmm. Is that leadership will stand up, be a little more consistent, and make sure we make sure the floor is civil mm-hmm. on both sides.
Sure.
All right, we've got one last question for you. Do you have any favorites running for election during the statewide races for governor or other offices this May?
Oh, you know what? I have not made any choices in the gubernatorial race, but I will say that I'm excited. I think whoever comes out of the primary on the Democratic side has an awesome chance, and we all need to rally behind them. So this is one moment where we should all feel good about everyone who stepped up I think there are some discourses happening that is needed. Mm-hmm. There are some voices that I look forward to seeing in the room in the future. Mm-hmm. And I made a post about this, that at some point we need to see a black person be governor in Kentucky. We need to see more members of color, diverse backgrounds in statewide offices in Congress from top to bottom. So I'm hopeful for those days. But right now I'm really excited about the candidates that are running for governor. One of my dear friends is running for auditor. Mm-hmm. So it's an exciting time. We need to be fired up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I know that you're close with Kelsey Kootz, right?
Is yeah.
That, yeah, and she helped you out in your campaign, too, earlier.
Yeah, so. Kelsey's a rock star.
Yeah, she's great. Awesome. She's great, yeah. Well, that's it. There's a lot of good people in the race. One dropped out, but there's still three good people running that race. So, all right, well, thank you so much for joining us. We really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate you, man. Thank you.
All right. Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @myoldkypod. They can like our Facebook page. They can listen to our podcast on the podcast app of their choice. We have a newsletter that you can subscribe to at forwardky.com/email. That comes out on Friday mornings. And finally, we have a Patreon where you can support what we do every week for as little as $1 a month. And that's at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.